Welcome to the world of Mark's Money Mind, coming to you from the Rocky Mountain town of Crested Butte, Colorado. I am your host, Mark Troutman, CFP. This educational, personal finance show combines money lessons, timely topics, personal stories, and community wisdom to help listeners and viewers master their finances to enjoy a stress-free life of financial freedom. All right, we are here at Camp Fi Rocky Mountain in 2024 in Colorado Springs. And I have my friend Emma Von Weiss with me. We met at a Camp Fi a number of years ago. And I wanted to ask you about that a little bit, but I'm going to give you my recollection of our first meeting. Typically at these Camp Fis, you will get on Facebook and you'll see a ride share. And so I recall flying in, and this was in Florida in 2022, as I recall, and I needed a ride to the event, and I think you needed a ride to the event, and somehow we ended up in the same car list or whatever. And I got to the airport, and I had seen your picture, and that was it. I just knew your name and your picture, and I saw you after we got out of the terminal or to the end of the terminal. And I was like, oh, I think that's Emma over there. And I was like, wow, she's pretty young. That's interesting to see somebody so young at one of these events. And I walked over and I said, I think you're Emma, right? And she said, yeah. And we got chatting and you said, yeah, I just graduated from college. And I was like, okay, I knew you were pretty young, but wow, okay. And I said, do you mind if I ask you when you were born? And you were born in
2000.
And I said, now, wait a minute. My daughter was born in 1999. And she had always given me pushback because I was like, oh, you should go to one of these Camp Fi events. I think you'll enjoy it. And she kept saying, oh, that's for people your age. I'm too young for that. And I recall texting her almost immediately saying, hey, there's somebody here that's your age, almost exactly your age. And as we were talking, you decided to come on your own. It wasn't like when Katie came to her first one, I brought her to this event. You decided to go on your own. So I'd like to hear a little bit more about your decision in making that choice to come. And it sounds like you had gone to a previous event too, right?
Yes. So my first event was Economy in November 2021. So just probably a month or two prior.
And that was the first Economy, I think.
Right? I think it was the second one.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I went there because Jeremy Schneider posted on, so Jeremy Schneider runs Personal Finance Club, just like a personal finance education platform. And so he posted that he was going to Economy and he was like, hey, there's still tickets open. Like this would be a really cool personal finance event for people that are interested. And I remember at the time I actually got my college to pay for me to go. So that ended up being mostly free to go to that conference. And I met so many really cool people and they seemed to know everybody. When you get to that check-in table at Economy, it's like a family reunion. And I was like, how do you all know each other?
And you met somebody who is actually here at this event, right? As I recall.
Yeah. So Alex Wong is the one, the original one. He was checking in and he just knew everyone. And I was like, Alex, how do you know these people? He's like, well, I met them at camp. And I'm like, you're 35 years old. Why are you at camp? And so we just talked talking a little bit more and I signed up. And 6 to 8 weeks later, I was at my first Camp Fi. The Florida location is a little bit funny because you have to drive like a mile down this windy gravel road into a cabin in the woods. And so for first timers, that can be scary, but I did know Alex. So that was a little bit more comforting.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask about, now, did you get the college to pay for that too?
No. By then I had graduated. Oh, I was okay. Off their payroll.
Okay. And it sounds like you graduated early then, right?
Yes, semester early. Yes, December 2021.
Cool. And I want to roll back the clock a little bit and get an understanding of kind of what you might call money scripts are, or what made you get interested in this at such a young age? Because I don't see that very often. And I think that's very unique.
Yeah. So I do think it was like a culmination of a bunch of things. I was very independent as a kid. So I also knew that my family did not have the kind of resources that I saw other people with. And so I just knew that my own personal finances, my large expenses, those were going to fall on me. And so just finding ways to make money as early as I could and saving that up for whatever I was going to need it for in the next 5 years.
And as I recall, you started working at a pretty young age. Why don't you tell me a little bit about that decision to work and what you did?
Yeah. So I found out that you could legally start working at around 14, and established companies do not want to hire 14-year-olds. So I ended up working for my aunt. She ran like salsa stands at a farmer's market around that time. She's now turned it into a whole food truck business, Roxy's Hot Grill.
Awesome. Good plug.
Yeah.
And where is that?
She's based out of St. Louis. Okay. And so I started off just like helping her with the farmer's market stands. But by the time I was 16, I was loading up my car, taking them to Ferguson, Missouri, and running the stand myself. And then by that time, I started working at a Mexican restaurant around 15. And so I would work during the week at the Mexican restaurant. Saturday mornings, I'd go to the farmer's market. And then Saturday afternoons, I'd go back to work at the Mexican restaurant.
And how did you like restaurant working?
I really enjoyed it.
And what were you doing at the restaurant?
I was kind of doing a little bit of everything. After a couple of years, I ended up being in charge, doing like the bank runs and everything and helping them with scheduling. But at first, it was really just working the cashier, helping get orders out. The restaurant did not follow child labor laws. So that was really beneficial for me because I would get to work overtime. And sometimes they had me slinging margaritas in the back. And that definitely wasn't legal. But I had a good time.
Awesome. I know Katie's experience with, and Katie is my daughter, her experience with restaurants, she did not enjoy it because she was actually a hostess the person when you come in the door that seats people. Mm. And she would get grief from the servers because if you weren't sitting them in their territory and all that, and she's like, I do not like working at a restaurant. So she avoided working in restaurants after that. So I was just curious about your experience there. And so what was the point of working at such a young age? Was there a goal that you were trying to achieve? And or were you just, was it a security feeling? What was the reason for being so diligent in working and making money at a young age?
Yeah, I had known that there were going to be large expenses that were going to come up, a car, college, that my family was not going to be able to help me with. And so really it was just working as early as possible to get as much money as possible because I had no idea how much I needed. And also just like spending money with friends, want to go out to eat every now and then. And
so it did give you some kind of independence as well. So that was part of it, right?
Yes.
And did you end up buying your first car at a young age or how did that all go?
So yes, I bought my first car. It was a 2009 Honda Civic for $5,500. I crashed it. Oops. And totaled it. Like 8 weeks later, oh, I think, man. I bought it in
did
July.
Did you have any insurance on it? Or
it was a salvage vehicle, so yeah. I did not have comprehensive insurance on it. And then I think 6 months later, maybe less than that, I bought a 2005 Ford Escape for $2,500. And that lasted me all the way until last year at 250,000 miles.
So how many years did you own that car then?
Ooh, at least six.
Yeah. Okay.
Seven. Yeah.
Wow. Very cool. And I want to talk a little bit about your college experience. You went to college, obviously, because I know that. And was that something you ever discussed with your parents on how you would decide if you would go to college, who would pay for it? How did that all go?
Yeah, college was just one where we never really talked about it, but I just knew they were not going to be able to help me pay for that.
Okay. And did they help you from the standpoint of making the college decision, or was that also on your shoulders?
That was also mostly me. I picked where I was applying. I figured out how to get financial aid to pay for the application fees. I ended up going to Park University after applying to a bunch of local-ish schools. So I grew up in St. Louis, and I really just did not want to go to school in St. Louis. That was like my one criteria. So looking at Kansas City and Chicago and Park University was one of the schools I applied to because a friend of mine had told me about it. And I ended up getting an honors scholarship there to join their honors program based off just merit. And so that ended up being the cheapest but they also had pretty sick dorms.
Okay. Yeah, because I do talk to people and I find that a lot of people in the community that I live in, those students will go on a tour of different schools and they're not looking at them based on what the cost will be. They're just saying, oh, this is a beautiful campus. I want to go here. And I've talked to various parents where they feel like, oh, my child wants to go to this school, but it's more money and I don't know how to say no. So I think it's very interesting that all of those decisions were on your shoulders and the economics of that decision were critical in the decision-making process. But I also understand you hacked college in a little way. So I'd be very curious to hear about that because I think a lot of people don't think about, they just think, I go to this four-year school, I pay the stated rate, and I'm done in 4 years or 5 years or 6 years, and it's just going to cost what it costs. But you had a unique way of hacking college. So I want to hear about that because I think it's very interesting for people to learn that there are other ways than just paying the stated rate.
Yeah. And a lot of mine just came from having conversations with people and getting to know what avenues were there.
And these people were who? Other students or were they?
Mostly adults. So okay. College counselors in high school, the student success coaches in my college, the financial aid people in my college. And so it really started in high school by taking as many AP and dual enrollment classes as I could.
So can you explain what dual enrollment is?
So dual enrollment is when you pay college tuition rates. Generally, it's like with a local community college that's partnered with your high school, and it allows you to get college credit for those classes. And I even ended up getting scholarships through my high school to pay for that.
Oh, wow.
Because I wanted to take the classes. And I asked. I was like, hey, I can't afford this dual enrollment fee. And they had options. And I actually ended up, a friend and I ended up splitting it. But yeah.
What do you mean a friend of yours?
Well, she also could not pay for
it. Oh, you mean splitting the scholarship.
So we ended up like splitting the scholarship so we could both get these classes. And then AP classes, which are not necessarily partnered with a college, but are generally more rigorous classes, college level classes, and you have to take a final exam. And based off of like the score you get on that exam, I think it's 1 through 5, that determines if it qualifies you to cover a college class.
So how many credits were you able to attain before you even started college then?
I pulled in 20 credits starting college.
That's crazy. And just for my recollection, because college was a long time ago, what is it, 15 credits a semester typically
about,
in college?
Yeah.
So you had a semester and a third under your belt before you even started college, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I also understand there's some other hacking that you did at college. So why don't you tell us about that? Because I'm very intrigued about that.
Yeah. So my first year of school, I think it ended up being closer to $8,000 to $10,000. And I had in my head, I could probably work and pay $5,000 a year.
And I do want to say that this is relatively recent. So this, you know, sometimes you hear people talking about this and that's in 1983 dollars. So we're talking about within the last few years. So this is real numbers kind of in very current dollars. So I just want to preface it with that, but continue.
At an almost out of state college where I was not living at home. Yeah. So it was.
That's a pretty lofty goal. And it sounds like you achieved that. But let's hear how you did that.
So first year goes by and I remembered taking those community college classes. And so I was like, I wonder if I can transfer some in. So over that summer, I took a couple classes through the community college, partly because I didn't want to spend 16 weeks taking a class when I could spend 3.5, but also partly because the community college classes were about $100 a credit hour.
And were these in-person classes or online? How was that?
They were in-person. Okay. Some were in-person, some were online. At this point, I think they were in-person. So then that went really well that summer. And I was like, I wonder if I can do this during the school year too. And the answer was yes. So I started comparing I lived in the undergraduate course catalog where it has all the course descriptions. And so I started comparing the course descriptions at the local community colleges to see which ones matched and which ones that I could take there instead and just transfer over to my college. And so I probably did that with about 10 classes.
And so that would be approximately 30 credits then, right? And 3 credits per class?
Yeah.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it was, and it gave me so much more time flexibility too, because I was able to take, and then during the school year, they were online. And so I was able to take these classes, like a biology lab class, in 3 weeks instead of 16. And so I got a lot more time back. And so after that, I was able to only take a few classes at a time, rather than the regular course load of 5-6 classes.
So you were effectively taking, let's say, 2 or 3 classes at the college that you were at and paying their rate, and then taking maybe 2 or 3 classes at the community college at the same time. Is that kind of how you're describing it?
And okay. It's very important to set this up early, because the community college classes are generally
Year 1 and 2, right?
Yes. Right. And so they have those, they're those gen eds, those English, the history, the social studies classes. And so it's really your first and second year where you can mix those in. And then after that, you get up to those higher 300 level major classes that aren't necessarily, you can't really transfer those.
And I really like the way you're doing this, because you're still, because a lot of people will talk about, oh, you can go to community college for 2 years and then transfer into a 4-year school and then finish there and get the degree there. But then the kind of the argument against that is then you don't get the college experience for the 4 years. But it sounds like you had both. You were on that campus. You were enjoying that college experience for that period of time that you were there. Now, I know it was only 3.5 years as opposed to 4, because you did it quicker. But you got that full college experience. It wasn't, because I have heard plenty of people say, oh, go to community college for 2 years, maybe live at home and get the 2-year general education under your belt, then go to a 4-year school. But then you're coming in as a junior, all the friends are made, and maybe you don't have as good of experience. But this is an interesting way to have both. So I really like that. And then I also understand there was some kind of military aspect to this hacking.
Yeah. So around my sophomore year of school, I was chatting with a friend of mine, and Park University is a military campus. Like, they have 1 in-person campus and 40 military campuses.
Oh, wow.
And okay. So they have deals for tuition for people in the military or families in the military. And so they.
And you had no military history in your family, correct?
None at all.
Okay.
And so it was unique to this school. It may be at other schools as well, but they allowed students who were enrolled in ROTC to get a reduced military tuition rate, mm-hmm. which ended up being about half of the current tuition rate.
Yeah. When I went to college, I had a number of friends that did ROTC, but they did it for 4 years, full ride, but then they had to go into the military, and they were going in as officers, which was nice, but you were able to avoid that in some respect. So I'm very curious to hear about that.
Yeah. So if you join ROTC, there's a 4-year commitment. You have to join or you have to pay back the money. But I did not go that route. I was allowed to, up to 2 years, participate in the ROTC program, get this reduced tuition rate. So they're not paying for my school, but I just have access to this reduced tuition rate. And so all I had to do, not all I had to do, but I had to go to class once a week. I had to do 3 times a week.
Class for the ROTC class.
Yes.
Yeah.
There was a PT, physical training, 7 a.m., 3 times a week. And then on Thursdays, I would put on my full uniform, gel my hair back, and go to lab.
Lab. What is lab?
Lab is where we do all sorts of things. We learn how to put on tourniquets. We run around in the woods with fake guns. Mm-hmm. We learn how to crawl. I wasn't good at marching. I did not have the coordination. But then after about maybe 6 months, I realized that to get the tuition credit, I did not need to go to PT and I did not need to go to the labs. So that was very exciting for me, and probably very exciting for the other students in ROTC, because I was not as engaged as they were.
And so what is the purpose of allowing people to be in this program without having to do the physical training? What was the goal, do you think, of this program?
Yeah. So I talked to the woman who ran the program at the school about it, and she just wanted people to get an experience with ROT without feeling the commitment to join the program. And so they were completely fine with me. They knew exactly what I was going to do. I was very clear to them that I was not, my goal was not to join the Army. I couldn't pass a PT test to save my life. So, but yeah, it was a great program. I made some friends.
So it was kind of like moderating the program to, for the benefit of the community in a way, I guess you would say, to understand what ROTC is, and maybe you would explain it to somebody else, or was it to get an appreciation for what people do?
Yeah, I really just think they wanted people to feel comfortable testing it out without that commitment of 4 years, have to pay this back, no going back kind of
thing. So effectively, you were able to get reduced tuition as a result of doing that. Well, there's another great hack that I've never heard of before, because everyone that did ROTC that I'm aware of ended up having to go in or pay it back, like you said. So I really like that. So when you went to college initially, did you have an idea of what you wanted to do? Or was it just like, I'll go there and figure it out? What was your thought process when you first went to college?
Yeah, I wasn't quite sure what I wanted to do. I think I liked math. I was good at math.
So did you elect a major initially or not?
Yes. So I started out as a math major with a computer science minor.
Okay. And what was the decision behind that? Just because you liked it, or did you think, oh, I could make some money doing this?
Yeah. So I was good at math and I wanted to do something in business.
Okay.
But I did not want to be a business major. I could learn a skill and apply it to the business, but I quickly realized, because every time I told someone I was a math major, they were like, oh, do you want to teach? That there's very few pathways with a math degree.
Right.
You can teach or you can go into actuarial science.
Okay.
And I did not want to be an actuary. And after about a year and a half, I ran out of math classes and the rest were like teaching you how to teach math, like proofs and stuff.
Okay.
And I realized that wasn't for me. But all the while, I had been just garnering an interest in personal finance and slowly learning more and more and more. And so I had joined a business and investment club because that was my end goal, is to do something in business. I wasn't sure what.
And were you familiar with investing at all at that time? Or
probably not, but I was looking for answers. Okay. And so that's why I joined this club, was because I was interested in personal finance and this was the closest thing to it. And then we had a professor who was the director of the financial planning program. He came in and talked to the class about the major. I was like, wow, this is really resonating with me, because this is what I'm doing with my friends, with myself, trying to help my family. I had really already picked up a lot of speed in my personal finance education at that point. And so it was really exciting to hear that that was a job avenue for me. And I very quickly switched my major and started taking those financial planning.
What year was that? Was that sophomore year or junior year?
Late sophomore year.
Oh, okay. Good. So it wasn't going to require some additional classes or anything like that?
No, it required a couple extra, but back to the college hacking, because I had taken a bunch of classes already and I dropped the computer science minor at some point. And so I had already taken some classes that were no longer super applicable. I spoke to the student success coaches at my school, and I was able to get some of those to count for classes that they didn't 100% correlate with.
Oh.
So I got special permission. So I switched from the math major. I demoted it to my minor. I was able to get one of the computer science mathy classes that I took to count for the math minor, so I could complete my math minor without taking an additional class.
Okay.
And I had to get special approval from the department head to do that, because it technically wasn't allowed for that minor. And so I was able to do that with several classes as well. And so that canceled out a couple classes that I was going to have to take just by getting them to count twice.
And did you have kind of a liaison at the schools? Like, I never really did that well when I was in college. And I know my daughter did do it quite well. And I'm curious, especially for somebody who's more recently been to college, was there a particular department or area that you found was beneficial in kind of guiding you through this process of making sure things count and all that? Because I know a lot of people end up taking longer to go through school because they don't really think about how to kind of path it out.
Yeah, I really didn't. And I was frustrated with that. The student success coaches and the financial aid office are not equipped to help people with these decisions. I spent so much time in that undergraduate catalog. I regularly ran into friends that were taking the wrong classes or weren't taking what they were supposed to because they were not properly educated. And so I had to do a lot of advocating for myself and a lot of research. When I first joined college, I created a roadmap of all the classes I was going to need to take. That's when I realized that when you make plans, they never come true. I used that, and I spent a lot of time. I would update that every semester as things changed. And so I did kind of have a roadmap for myself, but nobody helped me create that. I had to do a lot of time, again, looking at course descriptions, looking at the rules of the majors, and just seeing what made the most sense for me. And then I would take it to the student success coaches and be like, is this acceptable? This is what I think I can do. Do I have your blessing? And so that's what happened more often than not.
So a lot of it was on you. It wasn't like someone was really guiding you. And I do want to jump forward a little bit. So it sounds like you graduated from college in 3.5 years. You had this mentor that now was his mentor in the financial planning area. And how did you launch from graduating college into a career?
Yeah. So when I first found out about financial planning, I was like, this is really cool, but how does it work? And so through just college networking and just I would meet people or I would find them on the internet, I started reaching out to, because I wanted to be a financial planner, other advisors in the industry. And I would ask them to go to coffee. And financial planning is a teaching profession. And so many of them were just so happy to give me their time and to educate me. And I would meet with them and sometimes I would say stupid stuff because I wouldn't know the verbiage. And I mean, the industry is so broad, I didn't know where I wanted to end up. And so really meeting with all these people, and it wasn't necessarily for the purposes of finding a job. It really was to learn. However, most of those conversations turned into job interviews, job offers, internships. Just I built a really great network of people that wanted to see me succeed just because I had taken that curiosity in what they do.
Mm-hmm. Did you have an internship in college at all?
So one of those coffees turned into an internship, which helped me realize that was not the area of the industry that I wanted to be in.
And if you don't mind saying, what do you mean that area of the industry?
They were primarily an insurance firm was selling financial planning as a means to sell insurance products.
Okay.
And they were actually building out the financial planning. So that was fun for me because I got to help them build the planning processes. Mm-hmm.
But it gave you an opportunity to test the waters without actually having committed to a job and being like, oh, great, I'm in the wrong place.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And did you have more than one internship or was that the only one that you had while you were in college?
That was the only one, but there was a virtual online program through the Financial Planning Association that I did. The externship, I still recommend it to everybody because it was the most beneficial thing I did. But I used that as a resume builder, just this online program. It wasn't...
What program was that?
It was just called the externship.
Okay.
It was created around COVID because so many people lost their in-person internships, including me at that time. Mm-hmm. And so now they just teach financial planners how to do financial planning. And so that was a really great, it wasn't necessarily an in-person on the job training internship, but I learned so much.
And now the financial planning curriculum you had in college, that satisfied the education requirement for sitting for the CFP, is that correct?
Yes.
And did you actually take your test while you were still in college or did you take it afterwards or how does that go?
So with the CFP, if you're...
That certified financial planner designation,
yes.
By the way.
So to become a certified financial planner, you have to go through this education program. And I got very lucky that my school offered it because it's getting more common, but it's still pretty rare.
Right.
And then I always recommend people not to take the test right away because it's a very expensive review program and a very expensive exam. So I waited until I was with a firm that I really liked and I wanted to stay at. I started studying once I started there. I passed the test probably 2 years after I graduated.
Okay. And then that also requires a pretty significant amount of experience requirement. And do you want to explain to people what that is? Because I don't even remember, because people have been asking me. I'm a CFP, and I fortunately was able to use my, you know, historical work experience to satisfy that. But what is the requirement from the, you know, the hours that you have to?
Yeah. So there's two pathways. It's technically, it's measured in hours, but it's essentially years. 2 years of experience if you're working under a CFP, 3 years of experience if you're still doing all the steps of the financial planning process, but you're not working under a CFP. My bosses are certified financial planners, and so that counted for me for the 2 year.
And have you reached that?
Yes. So,
yay, when was that?
January of this year, I awesome. Officially became a CFP.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yes, awesome. Now, I want to talk a little bit, shift gears a little bit here, and talk a little bit about your approach to this, you know, financial independence concept and your approach to spending. And let's start off with the big three that everyone talks about: housing, transportation, and food. Are you doing anything particular there, or how do you approach kind of those larger expenses that you have now that I presume you're on your own? You're not living at home, correct? Yeah.
Correct. Yeah. So I have always had a roommate. That's the big thing, just to split those costs. Last year, I didn't have anyone to that I wanted to live with that the timeline matched up. And but I'm looking at apartments, and I'm like, I wanted a nicer apartment at that time. I wanted bathroom storage and maybe a pool if I got lucky. But those places are quite expensive, and they're being built to where they're really nice and even more expensive. And so I went online and I made a post in a Kansas City Women's Facebook group. And I was like, hey, here's what I'm looking for in a roommate. And I did a couple interviews, and I found my current roommate, Jennifer, who's really lovely. And we actually just renewed our lease. So we'll be living together for over 2 years by the end of next year. And it's gone really well. And it's made my apartment costs a lot more affordable while also getting to have a pool and a gym and bathroom storage.
So you did get the pool.
Yes.
And do you have your own bedroom?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And then I have my own bathroom, too.
Oh, wow.
Like, that was very important to me.
Yeah, because I know these newer buildings are really set up for that two-bedroom, two-bath instead of a two-bedroom, one-bath, and they come with all these amenities. And, yeah, they can be quite expensive, but having a roommate definitely helps out there. And how about, well, we mentioned transportation a little bit, so you had the older vehicle. How about now? You said that lasted until recently. What did you decide to go with?
Yeah. So last year I bought a 2013 Nissan Murano.
Okay.
I bought it from a dealership that I really liked the way they spoke to me, and mm-hmm. they educated me, and I felt like they were trustworthy. It was more important to me to buy from someone that was trustworthy than, like, I still did research on the vehicle, but I did get a warranty just because my last car had a lot of trouble. And I don't know, I just, the peace of mind of the warranty really helped me.
But the fact that it's effectively a 10-year-old vehicle at this point, or 11-year-old, that was certainly a much better price point than going out and buying a brand new car, because I'm sure you could qualify to buy a brand new car, but you decided to keep that cost low as well.
Yeah, it ended up being about $11,000,
yeah,
which wasn't bad. And I do remember a couple of years prior, my car was having car issues. And I was like, do I need to buy a new car? And I went back through my spending, because I track my spending regularly. And I was able to see, okay, I spend about $3,000 a year on this car. And then I looked up, what does the average person spend on their car? They're spending about $6,000 a year on their car. So I was like, okay, while I feel like I'm bleeding money on this vehicle, I am still spending less than the person next door, half as much. And so that was kind of my reframe to be like, okay, I can keep this car for another couple of years until it kind of officially dies. And it didn't die, but it needed so much work.
Yeah, you get to a point where the cost of maintaining it just doesn't make sense. Yeah.
So I got $1,000 for the trade-in. And now I have a car that should last me for the next 5 to 10 years.
And then I know they call the big three transportation, housing, and food, or housing, transportation, and food. I always wonder about food being a big cost. What is your approach to that? Do you go out a lot? Do you eat at home a lot? Is there an approach that you have to keeping your food costs reasonable?
Yeah, we do try to eat at home as much as possible.
You say we, so it sounds like you eat together with your roommate, which probably is even more economical than trying to feed yourself alone.
Yeah, so we cook meals together and we'll shop together and buy, like we both have the same morning smoothie and yeah. And so we buy stuff together and share on that a little bit. And then, but we do still go out to eat and we'll go out to eat generally on the weekends with friends. We're not like stopping at Cane's on Thursday evening.
Or having DoorDash every night. Or
we absolutely do not DoorDash because first of all, the food doesn't come warm.
Right.
It takes too long. I could have just driven there and gotten my nice warm Chipotle and I have a larger portion size because I stood there and it just never made us as happy as we thought it would. And so, yeah, we don't really do DoorDash or order delivery. We try not to eat out, but we do when there's a social element to it. Sometimes it can come from points of stress when we're busy and we're grabbing fast food, which I think is fine, but we just try to minimize that as much as we can.
And then you mentioned tracking your expenses. So how do you go about managing your finances? Are you tracking every single dollar? Are you just doing the kind of Paula Pants anti-budget? How do you kind of organize your finances, if you don't mind talking about that?
I really encourage people to track what is important to them. So I don't do Paula Pant style. I don't budget either. So I'm not like, oh, I have $400 to spend on food this month. I track everything just so I know where it's going and I can go back and look at it. But I do my savings first and then I know I can kind of spend whatever is left over.
Yeah, that sounds like the motto of this show, which is make some, save and invest, live on the rest.
Exactly, so, right. Okay. And so just doing that tracking really helps me in certain areas. And so that would be like shopping or Amazon, or like if I'm spending too much on Amazon, I might break out Amazon. And so that way it's its own category. And so that I can keep an eye on it until like I'm spending a normal amount. And it's also just so helpful for, again, I used it for the car to see how much I'd spent on the car. I use it for, oh, did my roommate pay me Wi-Fi? Or sometimes I need a new credit card and a bill doesn't get paid. And so I have a recurring transaction section. And if one's overdue, I can go check and see why that automatic payment didn't come out. So it's really just made managing my finances so much easier and being able to just go look back at the data.
And are you using a spreadsheet or a software program or?
I use an app called Copilot Money.
Okay.
I got that as a recommendation years ago from a personal finance creator that I really like, Money with Katie.
Oh, yeah. I know her show. Yeah.
And
she used to be in Fort Collins, by the way. I think she's in maybe California now, yes, or something. She's moved now. So it was funny because Katie went to school in Fort Collins and I was like, oh, Money with Katie in Fort Collins. That's kind of funny. But yeah, great show.
Yeah. And so she recommended the app and I love, love, love it. I had tried Mint and Every Dollar and everything else. And I just did not like the way they were set up. But Copilot was the first one that like really focused on tracking and quality categorization. And they have so much customization. So I could really make it to what was meaningful to me.
And I'll put a link in the show notes to that.
Yeah.
And is that one that brings in the information from your financial institutions or are you inputting it yourself?
Yeah. So everything is aggregated. And my favorite part about Copilot is they have this dashboard, which almost gamifies it. So the dashboard will pull in my transactions and I have to go through and approve them.
Oh,
and okay. Approve how they've categorized it on a day-by-day basis.
It does give you that extra step of recognizing the spending because I actually input everything myself manually into Quicken, which is just because I've been using it for decades.
Yeah.
And people ask me, why do you do that? And I said, because I want to own the transaction. But it sounds like by approving the transaction, you're able to kind of own that transaction.
Yeah. And I can go and I can make sure it was properly categorized. And if I have fraud coming through, I see that immediately because I'm checking my Copilot fairly regularly. If I see a subscription I forgot to cancel, I go cancel it immediately because I'm seeing that and I'm like, yeah, I have to review it. It's really easy. You just click mark as reviewed.
Right. But I mean, it gives you that extra step of seeing the transaction as opposed to the only time you saw it was when you swiped the card at the store.
Exactly.
Right. Good. I like that. And then what is your approach to saving? It sounded like you said you save first. So how do you do that? Is it just from your 401k or do you have other savings on top of that? And how do you organize that part of your life?
Yeah. So my 401k does not have a match. So that is not my first go-to. If my 401k had a match, that's where I would put my money first.
And you work for a financial planning firm.
Yes. They do a profit sharing they don't want the employees that are not as financially literate, who are not contributing to the 401k.
Oh, yeah, that's interesting. I'm going to step in there a little bit because my daughter, who works at a large accounting firm, has a similar situation in that, because I asked her when she, you know, got her job about the 401k, and she's like, actually, we don't have a match. I'm like, what do you mean you don't have a match? And she's like, no, they just automatically put in a set amount for every employee, just like you said. So I'm wondering if that's more of a newer trend for companies because of people, especially I've heard conversations about, well, they have student loans. We'd rather them pay the student loans off, but we don't want to not match them because they can't. So maybe that's the
exactly.
So effectively you're saying I don't have to do the 401k first to get the match. So you're not doing that. So I'm sorry, interrupted. So continue with, then what are you doing and how do you do it?
Then funding my Roth IRA is my first priority. And so I set up from my paycheck, whatever the annual contribution amount is divided by 24.
Okay, so you're doing it on a monthly basis.
Yes.
Based on your paycheck schedule, yeah, I guess.
Semi-weekly or whatever. Mm-hmm. So then I just make sure my Roth is funded. And then I do about 10% to my 401k, and then the rest goes into my brokerage.
And if you don't mind me asking, what do you think your savings rate is roughly?
About 25%.
Okay, cool. And just curious, because you are a CFP, what is your approach to when people ask the question, should I do Roth, should I do traditional? How do you help people make that decision? You're doing Roth yourself. And I don't know what tax bracket you're in, but I'm just curious why you decided to do Roth over traditional. And if you give any guidance, and this is not advice, this is just for education purposes, but any way to think about that decision process.
Yeah, it's really dependent on, it's all about tax rates, right? Because these accounts have tax rules. So a Roth IRA is after-tax dollars that grows tax-free, whereas a traditional IRA is pre-tax dollars that you are taxed when you take that money out. And so you're really looking at, when do I want to be taxed? And for me, I'm in my lowest earning years. I am 23. My salary is only going to go up. And so I am in my lowest tax bracket, which means I want to pay the taxes now and not later. Whereas maybe in 20 years, I'm going to be earning a whole lot more. I might be at my peak. Then I might want to switch to that pre-tax, because then I'm at my highest tax bracket, and I may be in a lower tax bracket later. So it's really just about where you think you are now versus where you're going to be later. And for most young people, you want to be in Roth because you're probably in your lowest earning years when you're 20, 21, 22, 23, up to, 30, 35, you are in your lowest earning years generally.
So would you say that doesn't matter which tax bracket you're in, it's more of an age thing? Or if, let's say, somebody in their late 20s is in the 32% bracket, would you still say Roth because you're young and you still may make more money in the future? Or how do you, because that's usually the question that I get. And the answer that I usually give is A, if you're young, and B, if you're in today's 24% bracket or lower, most likely it makes sense to go Roth. But then when you get into 32, 35, then the decision starts to change. But do you have an opinion of that? Or is it really, hey, you're young, this is going to compound for many years, almost no matter what tax bracket you're in? Curious, because I get that question a lot. And I'm curious how you would answer that question.
I think it's hard, and it can go both ways, just kind of depending on each individual person's circumstances. Yeah. I generally tend to lean, you're young, do Roth. And there's also just there's a longer time horizon for changes in the tax code. When you're older, there's less chance for
an unknown entity versus a known entity.
Yeah. Right? And when you're older, there's less room for changes because there's less time until you're taking out of those accounts. Mm-hmm. So when you're 30, there's a lot more room for things to change. And so you're locking that in now. But if you think that if you are a 30-year-old making millions of dollars right now because you have this tech thing that went gangbusters, and maybe this is a high, and after that, you're going to chill out and travel and go to Bali and have a really low taxable income, in that case, then you would want to do pre-tax because you're probably going to be paying, you're going to be in a lower tax bracket.
Are you also doing Roth 401k?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Interesting. And of course, the match or not the match profit sharing in your case goes in the traditional.
It goes in the traditional, yes. Right.
My daughter had the same thought process. Well, I'll do the Roth 401k at work because the match in her case, which is a match that doesn't require a contribution, but it's a match nonetheless, is traditional. And I'm like, you're already getting that mix anyway. And so I'm curious about, you know, we are at a financial independence event, and I've been to these for many years, as have you. And the discussion used to be more around, I'm going to save as much as I can and have this super extreme savings rate. And then I'm going to get to this financial independence point and life is going to be awesome. But with a 25% savings rate, mine was also in that same neighborhood my whole career. I was in the 25 to 30-ish savings rate. I'm curious of your opinion on how much is too much to save? How much, you know, is, I wouldn't say not enough to save, but how do you view that kind of balance between living for today versus saving and, you know, depriving yourself today?
So yeah, it really is just all about balance. I just try to keep my expenses low where I can. And like, I use this as an example, like deodorant, right? You can go to the store.
The deodorant example. This is a good, this will be a good one. Let's hear the deodorant example.
You can go to the store, and I had a friend doing this. You can go to the store and you can pay $8 for a can of aerosol deodorant that's going to last you a couple weeks, and then you're going to have to go buy another $8 can of deodorant. Or you can go buy a $4 stick that's going to last you 6 months. And so I see people making these kinds of decisions all the time, and they do really compound. People see wealthy people and they're like, oh, they're buying all these more things. Not really. They're just buying more expensive things. They're not buying a bed frame off Facebook Marketplace for $100. They're buying a bed frame from West Elm for $1,000. So there's just a different scale. And so I can live well and have an apartment with a pool, but buy the stick deodorant. And I can find ways to have quality items for less cost. And that's my car. I have a nice car, but I did not pay $25,000 for a nice car with all the things.
Yeah, and a new car, by the way, because I did just buy one. I did splurge, and they're more like $40,000 for a new car, by the way, just FYI.
But my car has a screen and a backup camera and an aux cord, and it has what I need. Awesome. Yeah. And so just finding ways to still meet your needs without going over the top to the extravagant item.
And I like that because I was actually at lunch today and I was like, oh, I'm going to write this down. And we were talking about spending, and the person at lunch was saying, spending with intentionality. And I love that concept. So even if it's a small, I mean, certainly on big items for sure, but even small items, like you said, the deodorant example, thinking about how you're spending money and also thinking it from the perspective of, is this spending important to me or is this item important to me? And maybe I can spend less on something that's less important and maybe spend more, like I've talked about in other episodes, on things that are important to me. So I like that intentionality of spending. And I do want to touch base a little bit on, because you're a younger person like my daughter, and I frequently talk to people in your generation about how can this message get out to this younger generation and what are the best ways to communicate with them? What are some of the important points to get across? You obviously have an interest in money for, you know, your whole life, it sounds like, whereas there are other people that are like, yeah, that whole money thing, I don't know. So how can, and this is really a way to help evolve this podcast over time, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to have you on here, is how do we, and you, and I say we, get this message out to the younger generation in the best way possible?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of really great personal finance creators out there that are providing amazing information.
And any ones you want to name that you find are, you mentioned Jeremy Schneider, for example.
Jeremy Schneider's Personal Finance Club is amazing. That is probably my go-to for young people. I always make them go follow his Instagram page.
It's on Instagram. Okay, and I'll put a link in there.
Yeah, just because the passive learning, I think, is super important.
And can you describe what his teaching methodology is or communication methodology is? I mean, obviously Instagram, but what is it that you find beneficial from his approach?
Yeah, he has these really amazing graphics that really break down each topic. And he talks about topics at a low level, but also at a complete level. So it's understandable for people that may not have a bunch of experience in that area, but it's still super impactful. And so like I'll see people on like TikTok, they'll give you three sentences and they don't give you the whole picture. They don't actually teach you what to do. And I think that Jeremy's account does a really good job of educating and giving you kind of those next steps. So really just trying to find those resources that you can follow that page and then keep seeing their stuff as you scroll.
Any other resources that come to mind?
So I really love, I mean, your podcast is amazing.
Well, thank you. For and young. And I didn't pay her to say that.
but yeah, I mean, like you are teaching to high school students in a digestible, in a here's the base things that you need to do first, and then here's how we build up. I think a lot of personal finance advice can start on like step three, when really a lot of people need to be on step one, paying down debt, getting a handle on what they're spending, cutting out waste where there is. It can be hard to know what advice is applying to you and what people you should listen to.
And you mentioned Money with Katie too, right?
I really like Money with Katie stuff. Okay. She takes a socioeconomic lens, and we'll talk about the economic
And by
factors.
The way, that's not my Katie. That's no. A different Katie.
They're both really cool though.
Do you know her?
No.
Oh, okay. Mm-mm. Just curious. And any other ones you can think of to throw out there? How about books, right? Because you mentioned you read a whole bunch of books, or you said you were able to digest information on personal finance. So what were your sources of material?
Yeah, my first like into real personal finance education was the Choose FI podcast.
Okay.
Probably about 2019, I probably found mm-hmm. that podcast. But I have a hard time recommending that for young people just because it's...
Well, they do have like 5101 now.
Yes, I don't know. They have that like online kind of course thing through their website, which I recommend the 5101
course. I'll put that in the show notes.
But their podcast, I feel like it's kind of hard to jump in.
Okay.
Whereas I really like yours because you started from the beginning. And so it's one that I feel comfortable saying, hey, you can start at episode one on Mark's podcast and just take it from there. And then it's one where... you have interviews and you have guests come on. So people are listening to your podcast. They hear a guest that they really resonate with. They can go check out that guest's other content mm-hmm. And just kind of spiral out from there. I think that's kind of how it happened for me with Choose FI. Like that's where I started. But then they had guests on and they had podcasts and I listened to those. And I just got so much more of a well-rounded education that way.
And are there any other podcasts you want to mention or...
I really like the Money Guy show as well. They kind of take a Dave Ramsey approach and give you baby steps of like, here's step one. Once you've got step one done, you have step two. They answer interview questions so you can see how different people's scenarios play out. And they're also fun and engaging.
I do want to talk about, you know, we're at an in-person event. And so you went to Economy, you went to multiple campfires. Are there any other in-person events or anything else that you might want to recommend, even people in people's local area or?
Yeah. If you're thinking about going to camp, come. I think that's an amazing time. Introverts welcome. People are so kind and once you come, you'll be like, oh, I wish I had come to this before. But I love the Economy Conference. That's a really good one. We've been going on the Fintox cruise.
Oh, yeah, Fintox cruise. Yeah. Yeah.
So we went last year and we will be going next year again.
I think
again.
It's sold out, by the way, for 2025, but you can always check and I'll put the link in there. It's Amberly Grant who runs that and I'll put the link to that, but it may be sold out by now.
And for young people, I think the Texas camp might be a good one because I mm-hmm. know Dan Sheeks has a program, the Sheeks Freaks, where it's really about kind of educating younger people. I think he's got people from 16 to 25 in there. So you really just have peers that you can talk with and connect with. And he brings the students to the Texas camp. And so if you are a young person.
And there are
a
number of us that sponsored tickets for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know Carl and Mindy from Mindy on Money, they have a sponsorship program. And I also contributed a ticket to that as well. So it's great to see younger people coming to these events.
Yeah. And then that demographic will skew younger. And so you'll be able to connect with your peers there.
Yeah. And I also understand that you are involved in a nonprofit organization that is also somewhat of a mentorship program. Can you tell me a little bit about
that program? Yeah. So that's Third Decade. I really love them. As a financial planner, we joined the industry to help people. But I also joined the industry to make money for myself and my family long term. And so finding that balance of how do I help the people I joined the industry to help? And this is one of the first organizations that I feel like makes it really easy. They look for mentors and mentees. And so how it works, if you join the program as a young person looking to learn, is you go through an education first, and then they pair you with a mentor. So that could be a financial planner, but it could also be a super nerd. I have sent many a camp member to the program to be mentors. And so they will look at your entire financial situation and they will give you steps on what to work on. And then a year later, you meet with them again. And then I believe there's a year later, you meet with them one more time.
And this is a 501c3, so the participants are not paying for this necessarily, or do they pay?
Nope, okay. They do not pay. And in fact, they get a $250 matching contribution to their Roth IRAs.
Oh, awesome.
Upon completion of the program and upon funding their Roth IRAs, $250.
Nice. Awesome. And I want to end here, but if people want to reach out to you, do you have any way that would be best for people to reach you?
Yeah. So you can just look up my name, Emma Von Wisey. I have Instagram. I have LinkedIn. You can reach out to me. I love chatting with people and helping them, whether you want to join the financial planning industry or just talk about your situation a little bit. I'm happy to help and happy to help you find the right resources.
And you will be on the FinTalks cruise,
and
right?
I will be on the cruise.
And any other events that you have scheduled coming up in the next year that you can think of?
If somebody has an extra ticket to Camp Midwest, I really want to go to that one, and it's sold out.
Aww.
I am going with a friend, and she got a ticket, and I forgot.
That's fine. There's usually somebody that might drop out in the last minute. So
yeah, but no other events yet. I really like the Florida Camp Fi. I really like the Rocky Mountain Camp Fi, and then just hanging out with the wonderful people that I meet in between those events.
Yeah. And just as an example, I know that you met up with some people in St. Louis, and it was just kind of a spur of the moment, like meetup, right? With people from this community.
Yeah. We had people come in from Louisville. We had Scott Miller come in from Seattle. We all just kind of hung out on a Tuesday at a bar. Like, we had a good time for 3 or 4 days. Yeah. And it was, yeah.
And that's what's great about this community. It really is about the people. It's not just we're sitting around, you know, figuring each other's numbers out. We do that to some degree, but for the most part, it's really about the community. So I really appreciate you coming here. I am so glad that I was able to meet you initially and all these other times. And I'm just so excited to see your trajectory over time, because I'm just so impressed with everything you did. So thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me, Mark. Absolutely. This is fun.
All right. Thank you for listening to this week's show. Please click follow on your favorite podcast player or subscribe on YouTube to ensure you don't miss any future episodes. Also, please leave a rating and review for the show. This helps improve the ranking and enables other like-minded people find the content in their podcast players. If you would like me to answer a question on the show, please send it to mark@marksmoneymind.com. and put podcast question in the subject line. Let me know your first name, or let me know if you would like to remain anonymous, and also your state of residence if you choose. I would also appreciate it if you would recommend this show to friends and family that might benefit from this content. See you next week on the Mark's Money Mind show. Until then, make some, save and invest, live on the rest. And now for the all-important disclaimer. This show is for education and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered investment, tax, or legal advice. Please consult the appropriate advisor or advisors before implementing anything you hear on this show or any other show for that matter. While I fully intend for everything on this show to be true and accurate at the time of each recording, occasionally errors may occur. So please do your own due diligence on anything discussed.